Today, neoliberalism, the seeds of our own destruction. Hello again, it's Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics, one of the latest posts covering finance and property news. I want to go a bit philosophical today because this past week I made shows about how to fix Australia before it's too late, and also Pop Goes the Property Weasel. Underpinning these important discussions is one simple point, which is that we are living in the shadow of a failed set of policies collectively known as neoliberalism. Neoliberalism has reshaped global economies, often delivering growth and efficiency, but at the cost of equity, democratic accountability, and social cohesion. Its legacy is deeply embedded in policy frameworks, yet rightly growing discontent and systemic challenges are prompting a re-evaluation of its principles. But whenever I talk about this, I get a flurry of comments from people saying, oh, it's not liberalism at all, or you don't understand neoliberalism in the first place, or perhaps worse, we need even more of the stuff. So today, I want to go back to basics and explain what neoliberalism represents and what has happened as a result of its widespread adoption. Here we should note that it's neoliberalism's very pervasiveness that acts a bit like an invisibility cloak. The situation is reminiscent of the joke about two goldfish. The water's cold today, said one. What water? Replied the other. The water is neoliberalism. Everyone is swimming in it, but without realising it. But you know it by its works. Economist Joseph Stiglitz defined neoliberalism as a belief in unregulated, unfettered markets. More broadly, you can define it as a political economic ideology that gained prominence in the late 20th century, advocating for free market capitalism as the optimal system for resource allocation, the privatisation of state-owned enterprises and services, the deregulation of industries and financial markets, fiscal austerity, reducing government spending and welfare, and globalisation, promoting open trade and capital mobility. The pros argued for by neoliberalism includes increased competition, innovation and consumer choice, rapid growth in energy markets like China and Chile, for example. The cons, on the other hand, are that it makes growth more uneven, with benefits concentrated among elites, while productivity gains are not matched by wages growth. In practice, we can observe that neoliberal reforms have actually widened income and wealth gaps, particularly in developed economies, while tax cuts and weakened labour protection disproportionately benefits high-income groups. Public services are gutted, with examples including the privatisation of healthcare, education and utilities. That's led in turn to higher costs and reduced access for vulnerable populations, and a market-driven model that prioritises profit over equity. Think about aged care and childcare in Australia at the moment. Consequences here would include the rise of precarious employment, gig working, zero-hours contracts, and reduce union power, meaning that job security and collective bargaining are eroded in favour of labour market, quote, flexibility. Neoliberalism accelerated global trade liberalisation, but also led to the offshoring of manufacturing and services jobs. This leads to the undermining of domestic industries in some regions and increased exposure to global financial stocks. When CBA sacks locals and employs Indians, you just wonder what's going on. We observe a massive growth in unproductive financial services while regional disparities widen. This flows on into the housing market through financialisation, which has led to asset inflation and the affordability crisis, while austerity policies post 2008 has put further strain on public services and on social cohesion more broadly. Now, critics argue that neoliberalism reduces civic participation, empowers corporations over citizens, while decision-making shifts from public institutions to market actors. Deregulation often undermines environmental protections too, as short-term profit motives conflict with long-term sustainability goals. And there is an emphasis on individual responsibility, fostering anxiety, burnout, and social fragmentation, which to my mind can help to explain the rise in mental illness, such as attention deficit hyperactivity disorder, ADHD, and obsessive compulsive disorder, OCD. So all up, societal success is measured by market value rather than collective well-being, while in fact, the well-being of individuals and communities are being damaged. Does that sound familiar? Looking back, this whole approach emerged as a response to the perceived inefficiencies in Keynesian economics, particularly during the stagflation of the 1970s. Economists Friedrich Hayek and Milton Friedman, through their respective books The Road to Serfdom and Capitalism and Freedom, set the scene for influential neoliberal policy shifts in nation states around the world. You could say neoliberalism's rise resulted in a reversal in the trend to fairer shares for reward to labour and capital in the decades after World War II. The Conservative government of Margaret Thatcher, elected British Prime Minister in 1979, and the Republican administration of Ronald Reagan, elected United States President in 1980, were perhaps at the vanguard. But also in China, Chinese Communist Party leader Deng Xiaoping, liberalisation of the People's Republic of China economy from 1978, in fact from 78 through to 1980, can also be considered a revolutionary turning point in the world society and economic history driven by those same neoliberal thoughts. As a result, Australia, like other Western industrialised nations, especially Anglophile ones, underwent profound changes over the last half century through the ascendancy and then the pervasion of neoliberalism. It is deeply embedded within universities, think tanks, the public service, parliamentary politics, and the media. These are all channels through which it is transfused and normalised, and it's become actually unnoticeably dominant, just like water. And of course, the IMF, the World Economic Forum, the Bank for International Settlements, and the World Bank, among other non-elected, non-governmental global organisations, are all enforcing the same neoliberal reforms and imposing these assumed values on developing nations, often with adverse effects. But the consequences of this let-the-market-rip approach and the resulting growing inequality, combined with the erosion of public services through government budget cuts and the privatisation of public service entities and functions, has created mass voter dissatisfaction in the West. Actually, the recent UK and Australian elections have led to one party with about one-third of the votes becoming the major governing party, raising the question of the limits of a functioning democracy. Another parallel force is the rise of digital media and its social applications. This has enabled the exploitation of the rising dissatisfaction for commercial profit, for domestic political purposes, and for the destabilization of Western policies by certain hostile foreign powers. And we can add in AI, which is also a mutually reinforcing factor now too, controlled by tech titans and dominating markets for profit, of course. Actually, the nexus of neoliberalism, digital media, and the destabilization of democracies by hostile state actor disinformation campaigns, you could say, culminated in Trump's executing a taker of the US Republican Party. Trump in office is undermining and increasingly dismantling long-standing democratic norms and accountabilities to establish a more autocratic, crony capitalist administration vulnerable to foreign influences. The trade war he declared in early 2025 at the beginning of his second administration ended the safe haven economic exceptionalism that the US had had since World War II and diminished the dollar's status as the world's de facto reserve currency. The tariff barriers raised by Trump in his signature Liberation Day on the 2nd of April execution order are, of course, a grand example of economic nationalism rather than pure neoliberalism, but it comes from the same stable with the same results. Neoliberalism paved the way. In fact, over the past decade in Australia, successive coalition governments and subsequently the coalition opposition led by Peter Dutton flirted with and in key respect lean towards the same Trumpist policies and political practices. And you could argue that the AUKUS defence deal, which of course the Albanese government still supports, is perhaps the perverse pinnacle. More broadly, the erosion of history as a discipline, as part of the defunding of the humanities, and the gutting of the capacity for historical thinking in elite circles, both byproducts of nihilism, have also played a key role. Atrocities begin in everyday life, so we need tools and concepts to peel away the familiar and the exculpatory, historian Timothy Snyder observed. Democracy requires individual responsibility, which is impossible without critical history. It thrives in a spirit of self-awareness and self-correction. Authoritarianism, on the other hand, is infantizing. We should not have to feel any negative emotions. Difficult subjects should be kept from us. So the history and impact of neoliberalism is a difficult subject which should not be kept from us, especially given the crisis of inequality that it has delivered. The trouble is, those who benefit from the wealth transference resulting from neoliberalism are the privileged few who are in positions of power, supported and aligned with large multinational corporations that are there for profit from the neoliberal approach. Such transformations cannot happen without the action and acquiescence of elites. And the elites, of course, are very good at hiding in plain sight, but they should be exposed. So the question is how to change the water. That is the key question we need to ask. This is, of course, not easy, as those in power politically, in the media, and in the corporate sector do not want to talk about their privilege nor admit that it is all deliberate. So step one must be to raise the veil on neoliberalism, which is what we try to do on the channel here. Next, we can articulate a different set of economic and social models where the benefits flow to the majority, not just to the elites, and where initiatives such as a public bank could facilitate a shift. Of course, the alternative is to simply allow the assumed default values of neoliberalism to continue to play out, leading to a societal collapse on the scale of the Roman Empire. There is, after all, nothing new under the sun. But let's be clear, shall we? Neoliberalism as a doctrine and as the economic basis for society does not serve the people. It serves the elite. I'm Martin North from Digital Finance Analytics. Many thanks for watching, and I'll see you again next time.